from the studios of KPCW in Park City. This is The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Mary Beth Maziarz. This morning we speak with brain surgeon Dr. Theodore Schwartz, who explores the past, present, and future of neurosurgery in his new book, Gray Matters, a biography of brain surgery. Then, the 31st annual Backcountry Benefit for the Utah Avalanche Center takes place on September 12th. Executive Director Emeritus Chad Brackelsberg joins the show to discuss the Utah Avalanche Center's cutting work in snow safety education and practices, while telling us about what might be the best party of the year. We'll be right back. Back to The Mountain Life. I'm Mary Beth Maziarz.
And I'm Lynn Ware Peake.
Our next guest, Dr. Theodore Schwartz, invites readers of his new book, Gray Matters, into the operating room with him as he completes harrowing tasks where every second can mean the difference between life and death. He explores high-profile case studies and dives into sports-related injuries, illuminating what differentiates one injury from another and how age, size, and other factors play a role. He joins us today to explore what it's like to make life or death decisions and to hold the weight of another human being's future in your hands. Dr. Theodore Schwartz, welcome to The Mountain Life.
Lynn, Mary Beth, thank you so much for having me. It's my pleasure to be here.
Well, your book, Gray Matters, was just such a joy to delve into. It reminded me a little bit of some of the medical memoirs by people like Oliver Sacks or Jill Taylor or Michael Crichton. So if you're a fan of kind of seeing behind the scenes of what people in high stress, high powerful medical jobs do, this is a book you might really like. And what drew you to this field?
When I was a kid, I think I definitely was into science. You know, I was one of these sort of nerdy Star Trek fans, but also at the same time, a musician. So I had this sort of love of sitting down and practicing something and using my hands to touch the world. My goal and my love and my dream was really astronomy and my dream was to be an astronaut. You know, I think I always wanted to be an astronaut, but I realized that that was probably nothing I would ever be able to do. When I first saw neurosurgeons operating during my medical school rotations, I watched them sitting in these chairs that look like a cockpit where the chair sort of envelops the surgeon and they rest their arms on the chair and they're staring into a microscope that's looking down to this deep inner recess of the brain and moving their hands, making very tiny, minuscule movements to manipulate delicate structures deep in the brain. And I think I just fell in love with that whole concept of being able to travel and voyage to a place that very few people get to go, to see sights that few people get to see. The anatomy of the brain is actually beautiful if you're a fan of it and if you study it. You know, if you imagine studying a map of the moon, you know, and looking at all the craters and imagining what it could be like. And then, you know, every time we operate and we go deep in the brain, we're basically getting off a ship and walking around on the moon, you know, and sort of looking at the incredible crevices and craters and mountains and dust-filled bowls and things and rocks that you know, sort of imagine seeing as an astronaut. And I think I got that enthusiasm and that excitement from brain surgery.
I remember a part in the book where you mentioned discovering a very subtle structure in the brain and describing it as startlingly beautiful. And I thought, that's so great. I hadn't really thought of, you know, vessels and nerves and the way things are bundled together that way, but I could see how it would be. You mentioned a little bit about how being a musician, several times it seemed like artistry came into it. Do you think there's a meeting of art and science in neurosurgery?
For sure. I think that the surgical process is in one sense a destructive process in that you're sort of altering the world around you, but you're also creating. You're interacting with the physical world. You know, they used to say, like, you know, how did Michelangelo create the David? He just took a piece of plaster or marble and then took away everything that didn't look like the David. And in a way, when you do an operation and you first see a tumor deep in the brain and you see that it's wrapped in normal blood vessels and nerves, you imagine in your mind what that will look like when the tumor is gone and all those nerves and blood vessels are still there. But you have to make that happen. You have to physically allow that to happen in a way that can be artistic in a way, because you have to, in a sense, shave away the tumor and dissect the blood vessels off the tumor and the nerves off the tumor to alter reality into a vision you have of the future of what it will look like when that tumor is gone. And it's not at all straightforward as to the moves you're going to make to get that done. When you first open up the head and you're sort of gazing down at what you imagined you'd see by looking at the MRI scan beforehand, often what you encounter is very different than what you thought you would find. You have a pretty good sense of what you'll find, but it's different in everybody. And so there is an act of creativity as to what am I going to do next? What am I going to do first? And every move has a result, and that result alters what you do after that. Because, you know, you may say, all right, my plan was to go around the left of the tumor, and you go around the left of the tumor and you're like, oh goodness, there's a vessel there. I didn't expect it. I guess I'm gonna have to go around the right side. So you start working around the right side. In the book, I make a metaphor about driving with the Waze app. You know, sometimes you think I'm gonna commute to work and I'm gonna take certain roads to get there. But then there's a flood, you know, and there's a road closure and you have to change what you do. And neurosurgery is very much like that. And there are floods and closures and obstacles that we encounter during our surgery that requires us to alter our game plan in real time.
If you're just joining us on The Mountain Life, we're speaking with a preeminent figure in neurosurgery, Dr. Theodore Schwartz. He's joining us to discuss his new book, Gray Matters. It's a biography of brain surgery. While we have learned a lot about the brain in more recent years about it, the plasticity and the malleability of the brain, there's still so much that we don't know. I say we as though I know anything about the brain, but you, it's still such a mystery. I mean, we know what the various regions of the brain, which, you know, what they perform in terms of cognition or memory or emotion, but beyond any other organ or part of the body, the brain is a mystery. How does that make you feel when you are in the brain with your instruments?
You know, I feel privileged, obviously, to have that someone, some another human being has trusted me with their brain, right? Because it is really is our most precious possession. There is nothing that we have that is more precious than our brains. And to allow someone else to have access to that for a brief period of time is a massive responsibility. And a privilege, you know, and I think most neurosurgeons never take that for granted, which is why we are so focused and dedicated to our craft and to what we do. There's a lot of ways in which neurosurgical operations, and sometimes, you know, experiments and studies done during neurosurgery have taught us an enormous amount about the brain and how it works. And I really wanted to talk about those because they make it very, very palpable. So, for example, you know, there's chapters at the end where I talk about the self and our identities and our common sense notion of ourselves. You know, when you see certain things as a neurosurgeon, it really makes you question those common sense held beliefs about the mind and the brain. So it's just some quick examples. You know, we all know we have two sides of our brain. We have a right hemisphere and a left hemisphere. And we all feel like we're one individual person, but we actually have two separate brains that are computing at the same time. And yes, they're connected by wires, but you can go in and actually divide the brain into two halves. And we do that as a treatment for epilepsy. And you can show that one half of the brain will be processing information in one way that is inaccessible to the other half of the brain. But yet, if you talk to the person after this operation, they don't feel like there's two selves. They still feel like they're one unified individual with one perspective on the world. And yet, you know that you can show half of their brain an item, for example, and their body will respond to having seen that. Or you can put an emotion, showing them a scary picture, and they'll suddenly feel scared. But you know that they won't be aware of why they're scared. And you'll ask, well, why are you doing that behavior? Or why are you so scared? And you'll see that the patient will make up a story to explain their behavior in a way that makes sense to them based on what they think is going on. And they take ownership of their feelings and their emotions and their behaviors that someone else has inserted into their brain, into a part of the brain that they're not conscious of because some of the connections have been cut. Things that we learn during neurosurgery make us clearly question who we are and our identities and sort of undermine this concept that we had control of what we do in all of our behaviors. There are even these really spooky experiments where you can put electrodes in the brain to record neurons that prepare for movements, like moving your finger, or the neurons that prepare for your speech, and show that there are neurons firing about a full second before you're even aware that you want to say something, or you're even aware that you want to make a movement. The neurons are already doing that activity to prepare for that movement. And the question is, well, if that happens before you've even made the decision to do the movement, who's really making the movement? Is it you, or is the brain deciding for you and you're just along for the ride?
Starting to sound like AI.
There are a lot of AI things we can talk about. AI obviously involves the concept of whether a computer could replace a neurosurgeon. Could an AI be doing what I do in the operating room? And I think that's something that I've thought about for a while. And there are aspects of what neurosurgeons do that I think could be easily replaced by AI. For example, when I prepare for a surgery, I may study an MRI scan and I may try to make a diagnosis of what kind of tumor I'm looking at from an MRI scan. And that kind of looking at an image and making a decision based on an image, I think an AI would do beautifully because you can feed it all the information, multiple MRI scans, and it can spit out what the diagnosis will be. But what I think an AI will have a hard time doing would be when I'm operating, I'm, as I said before, making literally 1,000 little decisions about the physical world. And I think that, AIs and robots and computers did not evolve like we did on a physical planet where we had to find food and we had to build shelter and we had to interact with the world around us and make physical decisions about the world. A computer evolved in a box on someone's desk and it evolved to solve certain problems, but those problems didn't involve survival, in a real world. So I think computers and AIs will have a hard time making rapid decisions in the real world and navigating the physical world. And that's really what neurosurgery is all about.
It was interesting to me when you mentioned you bring up Csikszentmihalyi's flow state, and there are several references throughout the book about kind of a sacredness or neurological nirvana, otherworldliness. Do you think that that flow that you're able to get into in a long surgery or really tricky surgery is something unique to neurosurgery, or is it something that many doctors may experience in the surgical realm?
I don't think it's unique to neurosurgery per se. I think that many surgeons lose themselves in the operations they're doing, whatever that operation may be. Obviously, I can only write from the perspective of neurosurgery, and some of our operations do tend to run on longer than some other fields, but many other fields have very long operations as well. So I think it's common to all surgeons where it's really a beautiful moment of, I call it the ultimate in mindful meditation, because you're totally focused on the moment when you're there. The outside world does not exist when you're operating because you're entirely focused on just helping this other human being at that moment in time and getting lost in this physical task that really plays out on a field the size of a postage stamp. Like you're just living in this very, very little tiny space, making tiny movements on a spatial scale where that most people don't live in. We spend our days on this little tiny spatial scale. So we're in this sort of unique quantum realm, living in a different world. And it's a world where a lot of the drama, human existence, day to day, the worries, things like that, you're not really worried about. You're not thinking about anything but just the physical task you're doing at that moment in time.
We're really glad that you're able to compartmentalize that way so that people can have better outcomes. Let's go practical for a moment. What kind of symptoms should we be aware of that are, maybe it's a recurring headache, maybe it's a blind spot, a blown pupil? I don't know what kind of things are normal and what kind of things might send you in to get checked out.
So the most common question I get, of course, has to do with headaches, right? Because headaches are obviously a pain in the head. People always worry, I have a headache. Do I have a brain tumor? What should I do about that? And I talk about that. There are some headaches that are worrisome, but headaches, as you can imagine, are incredibly common. So many people get headaches. But it turns out that only a minority of brain tumors will present with just a headache. And that's the only symptom you have. Most people have other symptoms as well. They'll have blurry vision, double vision, nausea, vomiting, weakness in an arm, a leg, a seizure, trouble with your speech. That may be associated with a headache. And obviously, anything like that is very concerning and should push you into an emergency room or to see your doctor right away. The other headache that we worry about is when you have the sudden onset of the worst headache you've ever had, and it comes on like a thunderclap. Because there's this entity called an aneurysm that we've all, I'm sure you've heard about. It's sort of like a a blister in a blood vessel in your brain that can rupture, and blood can suddenly escape and surround the brain and increase the pressure in the head. And if you have the sudden onset of a really bad headache, that is very concerning and something that should bring you to an emergency room.
Since you brought up aneurysm, and one of the things you cover in your book is some really interesting sort of celebrity cases. Let's talk about our president, President Biden.
So many people know, some people don't, that Joe Biden had two brain surgeries when he was younger for a cerebral aneurysm. He had two aneurysms, and it's not uncommon to have more than one because there are genetic as well as environmental factors that lead to aneurysms. So his first aneurysm ruptured and he had a severe headache that came on all of a sudden. They make the diagnosis. They brought him to the operating room. Two neurosurgeons operated on him, clipped the aneurysm. There was a rupture of the aneurysm while they operated. And then they went back and did a second craniotomy and took care of the second aneurysm. So the question obviously arises, you know, is there a chance, or to what extent did having a ruptured aneurysm or having a brain surgery affect his current cognitive status? And so I go through all of that, what we know and what we don't know. So there is no question that sometimes when an aneurysm ruptures, and there's no question in the short run, when an aneurysm ruptures, it impairs your cognitive abilities. So I think there's a good justification to say for at least 3 months, probably for a year of recovery, he was not functioning at 100%. But there are a lot of people who can make a full recovery after an aneurysm rupture. So unless he had detailed neuropsychological testing before his aneurysm rupture and surgeries, and then it was repeated afterwards, and they showed that there was a decline. Truth is, we just don't know, right? We just don't know. Neurosurgery in and of itself, just opening up the head, closing it, does not cause any permanent cognitive problems, assuming that the surgery doesn't damage the brain with retraction, irritation, injury to the brain during the surgery. So the bottom line from a neurosurgical perspective is it's certainly possible that it has contributed, but there's no certainty or guarantee that it has. And there are many people that can make a full 100% recovery. And unless you really have the testing before and after, you just don't know.
Again, it sort of plays into the mystery of the brain as well. And it makes me wonder about, I mean, you tell so many stories in your book about different instances, different people who have either emerged from brain surgery with some different outcome or maybe a surprise that the neurosurgeon wasn't expecting. Can you give us one of those stories? I go back to an artist that I met who was never an artist until after she recovered from a TBI, a traumatic brain injury, and suddenly she was this magnificent artist. And so I'm hoping that, you know, story can relate to something that you talk about in the book.
Well, two quick things I would say about that. There are instances of patients who have deep brain stimulators put in their brains that are put in to help depression or to help with obsessive compulsive disorder. And when that stimulator is turned on, they notice changes in their personalities that could be as significant as suddenly liking a certain type of music that they never liked before, which is really remarkable that you can change someone's likes and dislikes with putting an electrode in their brain and turning it on. And it really implies that we can change our personalities by manipulating the brain in certain ways. The original question you asked, though, was a story about a surgery. And I think what you were saying is where I changed my mind in a way, but I might have been misunderstanding your question. But for example, I talk about the fact that there was one operation I did on a woman who had epilepsy, and she was a mother with children. And epilepsy is a disease that can be really disabling because at any moment in time, you can sort of fall down and have this convulsion. You can hurt yourself. If you can't drive a car, it's very terrifying to look at. Like if you have children and they're seeing their mom have a convulsion, it's terrifying. So she wanted to have surgery to try to cure her of her epilepsy, which we can do. And so I did the beginning of the operation and we opened up her skin and we opened up her skull and she was under general anesthesia. I was about to open up the dura, the covering of the brain, and I saw that her brain was under incredible pressure. The dura is normally fairly soft. But I would, you know, you touch it with your finger and it was like I was touching on a snare drum. And I realized that if I opened up the covering of her brain, the brain itself would just shoot out through the covering of the dura and it would become damaged. And I had no idea why it happened. You know, we put an ultrasound in there, you try to look in there, you ask the anesthesiologist what's going on, because you think something is happening to this poor woman under anesthesia, and I can't see what's happening. And so we literally decided just to close her up and stop the operation. So we closed her skull, we put her, you know, skin sort of back together. And then afterwards, I had to wake her up and say, hey, you know, we had to abort your operation because for some reason, the pressure in your head was really high and I didn't think it would be safe to do the surgery. And she was fine when she woke up. But then I had to decide what do I do next? Like, do I try to do this again? And how do I convince her that I can do it again? And because we never found a cause, I really thought that this bizarre event would not happen again. And she allowed me to go back and do a second operation, open her up again, same anesthesiologist, same drugs. We opened her up and her brain was perfectly relaxed. And we did the operation. We cured her of her seizures, her epilepsy. She's never had another seizure since. But it just shows you how sometimes, you know, you can encounter the unexpected and you have to think on your feet and not just persevere with your original game plan, but sometimes you have to change it to do the right thing for the patient.
Yeah, going back to that kind of creativity response, depending on the moment. It seems like neurosurgery's beginnings were very primitive and that there was a lot of trial and error that brought us to where we are today, thank goodness. What kind of things do you feel we might see in the next 10 or 20 years?
Well, going back in the past, just quickly, you mentioned it, you know, I talk about the myth of the brain surgeon and why we have this whole concept of it's not brain surgery, it's so hard. And a lot of that comes from this guy named Harvey Cushing, who was the founder of neurosurgery. And when he first started practicing neurosurgery, and he really became a neurosurgeon in 1905, there was no such thing as a surgeon who did nothing but brain surgery. And the mortality of brain surgery was about 50% when he started. So half of his patients would die. And by the end of his career, the mortality of brain surgery was 8%. Which is still very high from our perspective. But if you think about going from 50 to 8%, it's really quite remarkable to think that we went from there and now we're implanting electrodes in the brain and we have these brain computer interfaces that we can put in that will allow someone who's paralyzed to move a computer cursor and work on a computer just by thinking and using the power of their mind or controlling a robotic arm or robotic legs or drive a car or even fly a plane. Literally just by thinking about it. So we've come a long way. And even though we don't know exactly how the brain works, and we don't know exactly how the brain creates the desire to move and the desire to do those things, because we have computers that can interpret the brain waves and correlate the brain waves that someone is thinking with movements, and the brain itself is plastic, we can create an interface really between a computer and a brain to bypass the body. And now we can influence the world just by thinking about it. So the whole concept of telekinesis, you know, and telepathy, all of those things are real. They're, you know, they don't exist in the way we think they do, but we have the ability to create telekinesis and telepathy now using science.
Wow. What a fascinating way to think of that. I was noticing in the book of how many, new formats, new techniques rely on cameras inside the brain and kind of using some digital and robotic tools. Do you think the next generation of neurosurgeon are going to be ex-gamers?
I played a lot of video games as a kid, I'll tell you, and I think it was extremely helpful. You know, there are gamers now, but when I grew up playing, you know, Asteroids and Space Invaders and all the games that are not as sophisticated as the games we play now, but certainly helped with my hand-eye coordination and working with computers. So I do think those skills are helpful as neurosurgery evolves, because a lot of the surgeries we do now do involve a computer interface where we have robots placing electrodes in the brain. We can put lasers in the brain and actually, you know, deposit energy deep in the brain. And we can have a treatment now called focused ultrasound, which is really remarkable, where we can essentially make a lesion in the brain and stop someone's tremor without opening up the skull at all, just using high intensity sound waves.
Isn't that amazing? Wow. We have been talking with Dr. Theodore Schwartz, and his recent book, Gray Matters Into the Operating Room, is such a fascinating book. Is there anything that you'd like to leave our listeners with, any kind of last wisdom about their own brain health, or if they know somebody who's undergoing some neurological condition right now?
I would just say that neurosurgical training is extremely rigorous and long. And although we always worry about some crazy doctor death story about something horrible happening to us in the operating room, I really want to reassure everyone that every neurosurgeon I've met and everyone that I've trained cares deeply about other human beings and their well-being. And they have put the health of others above their own lives and their selfish needs. So I kind of want to speak out, for my brothers and sisters in neurosurgery and say that these are really good people who are doing their best and will do their best for you to make sure that you have the best possible outcome, no matter how long it takes, no matter how much time it takes. And they'll be there for you to, answer your phone calls and take care of you.
Wow, that's wonderful. And there's a lot of compassion in your book. I think sometimes people believe that surgeons of all kinds have large egos and not as much compassion or sensitivity. And I certainly didn't see that in this book. Well, thank you so much for being with us, Dr. Schwartz. And I'm going to recommend Gray Matters, your new book, to anybody who will listen to me.
Thanks so much, Mary Beth and Lynn. Really nice meeting you guys.
Welcome back to The Mountain Life. I'm Lynn Ware Peak. Well, about this time of the summer when the heat begins to subside and the nights might require a blanket, our thoughts could be turning to snow. Well, the Utah Avalanche Center's biggest party of the year is the 31st annual Backcountry Benefit on Thursday, September 12th this year. Certainly the Utah Avalanche Center is thinking about snow. And joining me now to tell more about the mission of the organization, all the projects they're doing, as well as the Backcountry Benefit, is the Executive Director Emeritus and Park City resident, Chad Brackelsberg. Chad, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Lynn. Good morning.
It's always nice to have you back. You've turned over the reins to Caroline Miller, but that emeritus word, which we are sort of chuckling about, it sounds very academic. I think what it means is you're still there pretty full time at this point.
At least for now, yeah. I'm not sure if that's the fitting term, but it's sort of become history that that's your title after you hand off the reins. So I figured I would keep that going. And yeah, it's been a busy summer training in Caroline and getting the reins handed off. And I'm looking forward to be able to focus on some projects in this fall for the UAC. And yeah, I'm not really going anywhere, just a little bit of reduced workload. And it was time for someone else to lead the organization.
Well, I know that you have introduced Caroline Miller, but can you tell us a little bit about her and where she's come from and what she offers to the organization?
Yeah, we're excited to be able to brought Caroline on. And she was moved here from the Tahoe area where she was working as director of operations at Kirkwood Resort. And so before that, she had some nonprofit experience. So she has this just wonderful operational risk management and nonprofit experience that she brings to the UAC. And so I think it'll be a great skill set to keep us moving forward and to keep the innovation alive that the UAC is just so well known for.
That's quite a change of direction. I mean, it's all snow, but to go from Kirkwood now to the backcountry, was that something that she had wanted to get into?
Yeah, her passion is more on the backcountry side than the resort skier side. And so it was a really good fit for her. And really, it's not that much different. Yeah, she's moving from snow to snow. I came from tech to snow. So, it's a much smaller step for Caroline than I had to take.
Well, let's start first by talking about the 31st annual Backcountry Benefit. It's always on a Thursday. It's on September 12th of this year. It is such a fun party. Tell us what we can expect.
Yeah, not only always on a Thursday, but always the second Thursday of September. So, truly traditional. We're really excited. Once again, live music, food, drinks from Uinta Brewing, Dented Brick Distillery, and Park City's own Old Town Cellars. We're also making some really fun changes this year. So we're going to have a larger vendor village with over 50 vendors for you to interact with and meet and see some of their new product for the coming winter. We're implementing a vert challenge. So the goal of the night will be, can you have a 10,000-foot day? And doing various things during the party, whether that's interacting with vendors or with the UAC. You learn vertical gain, and at different areas along the way, you'll get prizes. And so we think it'll be really fun. We're stepping back maybe a couple decades. We're putting in a dunk tank. So you're gonna be able to dunk your favorite forecaster or athlete. Biggest change though, really, is we're getting rid of that big silent auction tent. So we've decided we really want this to focus on the community, on the vendors, and getting them together and having fun. And so instead of that huge white tent, we're gonna actually have an online silent auction after the event. And really, we want this to focus on getting the community together to kick off winter and hoping that everybody, you know, can have a great and safe winter and have fun at the event.
You know, that just sounds brilliant to me, because we all know, we've been at those events where there's a silent auction and you have to either be serious about socializing or serious about the silent auction. The two don't really go hand in hand. And what you, as you're saying, you want to create this community feeling, which I've really felt that when I've been to the Backcountry Benefit in previous years. And many years, I've just completely missed the silent auction for that reason. So yeah, that's a good move as it becomes more of a party.
A big question though, Lynn. I mean, do you think we could have a dunk your favorite KPCW host?
Okay. I'll send Leslie down. I'm out of town that day. Thankfully, people always love a dunk tank, right?
Exactly. Yes. We've talked about it probably for 6 years. And so we're finally making it happen. We think it'll be fun.
So going back to, was it 10,000 feet of vertical idea is the challenge within the party?
So you'll do it at the party. So we'll have a little, you'll get a little punch card and you come in, and various things that you do will earn you from 500 to 2,500 vert for doing things. And then as you get the punch, you collect that vert and then you bring it over to the UAC, and you can get anything from a net gator to hats and a few other things based on how much vert you acquire that night.
Okay, that sounds like fun. And as always, the raffle opportunity drawing rather will commence.
Yes, we will still have a big opportunity drawing, and a change of that, instead of just one ticket for everything, you'll actually be able to put in your ticket for what you want to win. And so more of a specific thing. So if there's something that you really have your eye on, you could just buy tickets for that item.
Well, the opportunity drawing is always fantastic. I have to say, 1 year, well, I didn't, but my husband won some skis. It's a great event, great part of it.
Yeah, we'll definitely have some skis in it, some avalanche rescue equipment, some experiences, lots of fun things will be in that drawing.
And for those who don't know, the event takes place at Black Diamond Equipment headquarters. That's on 2092 East. It's on 39 South. Just get off 215 and go 39th South until you see all the people biking, walking, and parking to get to the biggest party of the year. A really good time. Tell us a little bit more about how we can get tickets, and do tickets sell out?
Yeah, tickets are available at utahavalanchecenter.org, and they have been known to sell out. You know, we have 1,500 tickets available, so I think it would be, you know, you'd want to get your tickets in advance. They also are lower price the earlier you buy. So, you know, get them ahead. It also helps get you in the event faster, so you don't have to wait in line if there's tickets available to buy a ticket at the door. It is our largest fundraiser of the year, and it makes up about 8% of the money we need to deliver avalanche forecasting across Utah.
Let's talk then about budget and what it costs to deliver avalanche forecasting across Utah. I know that Utah Avalanche Center is really cutting edge, leading really the charge in what you do.
Yeah, it's avalanche science was invented in North America, in Utah, up at Little Cottonwood Canyon back in the 1930s. And so, you know, we're standing on the shoulders of those that came before us. Some of these people who, the things they developed are still used, the Ed La Chapelles, the Monty Atwaters, all these people just built this amazing history and tradition of avalanche science in Utah. And so it's really humbling to be still able to take part in that and to continue it. And so we've done that in a lot of ways. And if you look at just recent history, you know, the UAC developed and released the first ever avalanche educational video back in the late 90s. We developed the first ever avalanche icons in preparation for the Olympics. Before that, it was just text-based avalanches. one of the first websites for avalanche centers. So yeah, we've really just always been looking at what's next and how can we reach more people? How can we get better information into people's hands so that we can help prevent avalanche accidents and especially fatalities?
What is your overall budget?
It's about $1.8 million to deliver avalanche education and forecasting across the state. And that ranges from the Abajo region down in south by Monticello all the way up to Logan.
Yeah. How many forecasters do you have these days?
Yeah, so total our team is about 20 people with two interns each season as well. And 11 of those are our forecast staff. And the rest of the team is all delivering avalanche education awareness, as well as doing all the fundraising to support those programs, because the nonprofit has to raise about 80% of the money it takes to deliver programs across Utah.
So for our listeners, just delineating between the Forest Service portion of the UAC and the nonprofit organization, does the nonprofit arm raise money for the Forest Service arm, or do they have their own funding?
Both. So about the 20% that we don't raise does come from the federal government, Utah, as well as various counties across the state. The rest of it we raise, and then we have what's called a cost share agreement with the Forest Service. And so we cover all the costs above and beyond what they have a budget for. And so that allows us to keep as many forecasters as we need out in the field every day, and not be reliant on the government funding to grow and to enhance. And so if we see a need for additional staff, the nonprofit can actually cover those costs, but the forecasters themselves can still remain Forest Service employees since they are working on federal property. It provides them a lot of benefits to be a Forest Service employee.
If you're just joining me on The Mountain Life, I'm having a conversation with Chad Brackelsberg. He is the former executive director of the Utah Avalanche Center, now executive director emeritus, has recently handed over the reins to Caroline Miller. And we're talking about the upcoming 31st annual Backcountry Benefit coming up on September 12th at Black Diamond Equipment in Salt Lake City. It's a great party. Chad, let's talk a little bit. You are always expanding your services and what you do, and especially in the realm of education. Start in early November when there may or may not be snow, but.
Yeah, we're going to kick off the year every year in October, even late September, with awareness season. And so that's where we are at local ski shops, snowmobile shops, outdoor, anywhere somebody wants to host a talk. And we'll do anywhere from 1 to 2 hour, just what we would consider an awareness presentation, get you ready, get you thinking about snow, get you thinking about avalanches. And then that really jumps, as you said, right into our on snow classes. We have around 35 on snow classes planned for this winter from, as you said, November through February. And we're really excited this year, in addition to our regular avalanche rescue class and our Backcountry 101 and Backcountry 201, this year we're launching a avalanche rescue and backcountry first aid class. So it'll be a full day class with half the day focused on avalanche rescue and the other half on some basic backcountry first aid skills. And so if you haven't had that wilderness first aid class or that wilderness first responder class, this is a great intro to give you those skills to make sure that, you know, you may not have an avalanche accident, but you might wrap your knee around a tree, you might dislocate a shoulder falling, and do you have the skills to know what to do in those events, not just in the event of an avalanche?
So who is this class for? Who can join? Can you join without any previous training?
There is no prerequisites for this class. So this class is for absolutely anyone. We're actually going to offer a couple private classes of this for some kids groups. So really 14 years and older. And so I think it's going to be a great asset to the community to have this introduction class for both of these skills. And even if you've had, maybe you've had a wilderness first aid class 4 or 5 years ago, and maybe you took a rescue class 3 or 4 years ago, this would be a great refresher for you as well. So it's not just people who haven't had any training, but this is also a wonderful refresher class. And we're really excited to be partnering with a group called Backcountry Ready to deliver the first aid part of this. So super excited, and hopefully it's a success for for us and for the community.
I'm wondering if you created this class to kind of fill a void. I know Wilderness First Responder and even Wilderness First Aid, it's a pretty big time commitment. I'm wondering if you wanted to offer something that, you know, gave some cursory skills that people need if they haven't been able to find the time to do Wilderness First Responder.
That was definitely one of our reasons. As you said, you know, by the time you take your avalanche classes and your first aid classes, you know, it's days off of work. It's a lot of money of registration. And, you know, our approach to education has always been give people that first step so that they have a bare set of skills to be safe when they're traveling in the mountains. And, you know, really for this first aid, it doesn't matter if you're backcountry skiing or hiking or mountain biking, these skills come in handy. And so be able to offer an introduction class that's readily accessible from a financial perspective is always one of the important factors for the UAC.
Tell me again when this course is offered and what is the cost?
Yeah, the first class of this is December 12th and it is $215. And we will be offering at least one more in both January and February. And I don't have those dates in front of me, but I believe it was early January we were planning it. But on the Utah Avalanche Center website, if you go to education and there's a classes drop down and you can choose UAC classes, and that will give you a list of all of our upcoming classes.
Okay, great. And registration, is it open for all these classes? So you can get way
registration ahead. Is open and people are already registering.
Oh, good. All right. Better reserve my spot. Okay, let's move on to in the recent newsletter that you put out, you talked a little bit about some more technology and you're that tech guy. You came from the tech world to the UAC. So I understand you're going to have a new mobile app.
We are. So over the next really about 14 to 15 months, we'll be launching a new mobile app, which will be available on both iOS and Android. Our current app is only available on iOS and it hasn't been updated for several years. It's definitely looking like a little archaic right now. So we're really excited to have a new, more functional app for both platforms on that. And so we're still trying to work out exactly when, but hopefully by the middle of the season, that will come out. And then we're also going to be launching a new website next year. The platform that our website runs on is going out of support. And so we weren't really wanting to do a new website, but when that happens, you don't have a choice. And so that will be available really for the 2025-2026 season, but we'll launch sometime in about a year before the season starts. So it's going to be a busy winter for us on the back end, getting all these things built up.
Your mobile app, what does it offer that the website does not? It seems like when I go out, I often check the website ahead of time, but then I don't really go on to the mobile app. What should I be, you know, why should I be using the mobile app?
Yeah, the mobile app was built to sort of be your dashboard or your first stop for your planning. So you can get your morning forecast out there. You can actually, we have a bookmark My Weather, which is one of the features I like the most. You can bookmark different NOAA weather pages for the places that you go most often, so you can quickly check your weather. It has traffic cameras and road conditions. So if you forget to check before you leave home, you can check, oh, is Little Cottonwood closed? Or what are the cameras showing for traffic backup in one of the canyons? And then it has an inclinometer on it. So if you do see an avalanche or if you dig a snow pit, it has an easy to use inclinometer that has the latitude, longitude, and your elevation on it. So you know, click a photo of that and gets you all the information for when you submit your observation at the end of the day. And then just some general information, things like what to do in a backcountry emergency and a few other things. And so we're still evaluating any additional and new features that we'll have in this new app.
It's very useful. Chad, I'm wondering in all of the different types of education that you have out there, and there are many, what do you think is the most effective? How do you feel like people are learning the best? Is it classes? Is it online?
You know, I'm gonna actually answer that a little differently in that it's through continued learning. So avalanche education is a lifelong journey and it's really finding how do you do it every year. So it does take that starting place of something like a Know Before You Go presentation which, you know, we start at your eighth grade level. And so kind of getting that base, and then you build on that base through a backcountry 101, a level one, a level two. But then it's also like, what are you going to do each year to refresh those skills? So, you know, we forget a lot. We have a lot going on in our lives. There's so much that we have to try to remember. And so having a system to where every fall you do something to relearn or refresh those skills, whether that's online learning, reading a book like Staying Alive in Avalanche Terrain, getting out with your friends and practicing, you know, you don't need snow to practice with your beacon. You can bury your beacon in a pile of leaves or under trees in your backyard. And so it's really just that continued learning and finding what you can do to keep those skills fresh and keep it exciting. It's fun. And so, you know, make these things enjoyable to learn about. And when you're on the skin track or driving to the trailhead, you know, talk to your partners about various things that you're thinking about to help, you know, share that knowledge and almost a kind of an informal mentorship in that way.
That's so great. Well, I believe that, you know, when you start looking at the UAC website and the beginning, the first snow, and keeping track of the snowpack, it's invaluable as the snow kind of continues to fall, and really getting almost like an intuitive collection of knowledge about the snowpack is really important. Is there anything you can tell about like this time of year? Do you look out there and say, oh, it's setting up for XYZ?
You know, that's a coin flip on that one. I will say that, you know, we all love to, maybe, whether you read the Farmer's Almanac, you look at the long-term ranges, you're looking at the ocean temperatures, you know, really anything can happen when it's this far out. And, you know, we know what's going to happen once we get some snow. And, you know, what we look more at is, when does that first snow fall? And, you know, the last few years, we've had that early season October snowfall, and that's fine in the south aspects. The sun hits and it melts, but those shady high elevation north aspects, that snow just doesn't go away. And so those are the storms that set up are a dangerous year. When we get early October snow and it just doesn't snow again regularly. So for us, we always like to say, you know, we don't want it to snow until the middle of November or Thanksgiving, and then it just doesn't stop. And so yeah. Keep the snow coming. It doesn't have that weak faceted layer to land on. And yeah, that really just sets us up for a great season of not having that deep, persistent weak layer that causes big avalanches until January, which that's what we really don't like to happen.
Yeah. The new weather models, it seems to me, well, I'll just say from a personal kind of anecdotal point of view, this summer, these monsoon rainstorms that have been coming in, I've never heard so many break-ins to the radio, the National Weather Service, you know, weather warnings, as I've heard this summer. And it makes me wonder about climate change and those weather models that are coming up, bigger storms. Do you have a sense, is that something that's been happening?
You know what, I'm definitely not an expert on this at all, but you know, I guess what they say is we're going to see more extremes, more hotter hots, more colder colds, wetter, you know, wetter seasons. And if you look, this monsoon season has been, you know, July was hot and so, so dry. I mean, the trails up here were just in horrible shape from the moon dust. And then I generally think of Utah's monsoon season as, you know, you get that 15-minute thunderstorm in the afternoon. But you know, the last week, we've just had some torrential downpours with some of the most impressive lightning activity I've ever seen up here. I was sitting at Hugo Coffee for a meeting on Sunday when that storm hit, and it was unbelievable to watch the lightning over Snyderville Basin when that came in. It was awe-inspiring for sure. And then if you even look at two winters ago, you know, 900 inches of snow at Elta, right? It's just, you know, very strange weather patterns considering that was 200 and some percent of average, and the year before we were at 68% of average snow. So we're seeing these extremes, and I don't really think that they're fully predictable.
Yeah. Well, by way of kind of wrapping up here, Chad, and going into some of this weather modeling and technology and even AI, machine learning, all of these things that you're probably kind of familiar with, is this the future of avalanche forecasting and prediction?
You know, I think machine learning and some of this will probably have the biggest impact on machine learning since the internet. And so since we started putting forecasts online and you no longer just had to call the phone line, we are working on a project with a various group of people from the University of Utah, some other mechanical engineers and some physicists on using models to help basically create a decision support tool for our forecast staff in forecasting using weather data, weather models, and then computer models to help understand it better. And then eventually with the goal of this will become public information. So those people who recreate down in the Tushers, we're not able to have a forecast for the Tushers, but with this technology, we'll be able to provide snow data for areas like the Tushers to help keep people safe. And it's super exciting. We're going to see where it goes. But you know, last winter, we did our proof of concept, and it was super successful. It met all of our criteria. So we're hoping to operationalize it this winter and have something with luck for the public the winter after.
Wow, excellent. So that's one of these special projects you've been speaking of that you'll be working on. Is that right?
That is, yes.
Well, that's really exciting. I mean, I can only imagine that sort of thing augmenting the knowledge and wisdom that really experienced backcountry folk have amassed over the years. But then for people who aren't as experienced, it really will serve as a second brain, maybe.
That's what we hope, yes. Or at least a piece of one more tool they can use to help make good decisions.
Yeah, that's great. Well, I've been speaking with Chad Brock. He is the Executive Director Emeritus of the Utah Avalanche Center. Get your tickets, utahavalanchecenter.org. Tickets for this year's, the 31st Annual Backcountry Benefit coming up on September 12th.
Get your tickets early. Come and have fun. It is one of the biggest fundraisers of the year for us, and it's one of the biggest backcountry parties of the year across the state. You know, 1,500 people. It's a blast with great food and great music and a ton of fun. So we hope we can see you there.
Chad, always great to see you. Thank you.
Lynn, it is always great to catch up and to talk with you.
I'd like to thank our guests today, Dr. Theodore Schwartz and Chad Bracklesberg. You've been listening to The Mountain Life on KPCW Park City at 91.7 and 88.1 FM in Summit County, 91.9 FM in Wasatch County.